Советский Союз – страна, экономика, основанная на общественной собственности. В Советском Союзе нет резких различий в уровне...
Генеральный секретарь ЦК КПСС, председатель...
Леонид Ильич Брежнев.
Генеральная встреча Леонида Брежнева с президентом Соединенных Штатов. Учение
отношений между СССР и США.
Russia's on the march, flaunting its military muscle. The West is in a funk, suffering from a deep crisis of confidence. An unassailable autocratic regime is embedded in the Kremlin, dissent is suppressed, and the public is largely acquiescent. Politics in Moscow has become a series of empty rituals. Talk of stagnation is rampant. 2016? Well, sure, but this could also describe the world of the late 1970s. History doesn't repeat itself, but as Mark Twain famously said, it sure does rhyme. So what do the 1970s really teach us about where Russia is going today? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey, Dan.
And also joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist and author Anna Aratunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome to the podcast, Anna. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And I'm old enough to remember the 70s pretty clearly, and sometimes I can't help but have a sense of deja vu. The Atlantic Alliance was divided, America was retrenching after Vietnam, and there was a sense that America had lost its clout in the world. The Soviet Union appeared, at least from the outside, to be a strong, confident, and appeared to be running circles around the West. It was intervening and making strides in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Soviet system appeared to be a solid monolith. This was, of course, all an illusion. Now, the Putin as Brezhnev meme is well-worn, for sure, and God knows I've milked it for all it's worth. It's worth at various times. But this period does, I think, teach us something about Russian domestic politics and foreign policy. Anna, let's start with you. What, if anything, does the experience of the 70s teach us? I mean, for me, the two common denominators I see are stagnation and Russian assertiveness. Do you see any parallels here and any lessons?
Absolutely. I mean, looking specifically at the domestic situation, I mean, what it feels like here. I mean, I do have to say I wasn't around in the 70s, but I'm hearing this a lot. Just on a level of living standards and what it feels like to really live here right now. We're stuck. We're stuck economically. We're stuck strategically. And now that the passions over Ukraine have died down, we're stuck ideologically. And I think this kind of flows into the thing about Putin is that this is a person ultimately without a clear vision. And I'm saying this neither as a good nor a bad thing, because vision in the context of Russian history has been known to propel a great deal of bloodshed. But in the 16 years of his rule, he's toyed around with a whole assortment of visions. And by now, they're kind of getting old. Maybe this is just a feature of governance that is particularly apt for Russian realities, where you have a certain theatricality of assertiveness and intent and really no underlying vision to go along with that. Maybe this is just the way you really stay in power for so long. But I think the major difference where we have to be careful when we talk about Brezhnevism and, you know, the Brezhnev stagnation is what this all means for people's lives. And talking to people from different generations about this, what you hear is that in the 1970s, for instance, the average citizen had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen to him tomorrow, what was going to happen to him next week, next year, when he got his promotion, when he retired, pretty much up until he died. And there wasn't much opportunity for planning because everything had kind of been planned out. But what I'm seeing now among the middle class, if we're going to talk about something of a middle class, which obviously was a completely different middle class back then, but right now is that people don't know what's going to happen. And as a result, a lot of them have stopped making plans, or they're soldiering on in a kind of fatalistic way. And one really telling thing I've noticed, there's an ad campaign by this new bank called Tochka, whose clients are largely entrepreneurs. And one of its ads basically says, the musicians on the Titanic kept playing, and so should you. what's the end game here? I mean, people really have no choice. I mean, they're not going to grumble about it because people are smart enough to realize that, you know, what's the point? But yes, there is a feeling of that. And it's not like there's a nostalgia for, you know, Brezhnev era stagnation, but there are clear, you know, differences between what's happening now and what's happening then.
Well, that's interesting, Anna, because what I hear from you is that the Brezhnev era stagnation looks positively positive compared to what you have now, because then you had stagnation with a modicum of stability and predictability about the future, and whether it was although it turned out to be an illusion, now you have stagnation and people don't know what's going to happen next, and they're worried about that. Would that summarize your thoughts?
I mean, in a very big way, yes. But we have to be clear that. I have to be honest, if I had to choose, I would still choose to be here right now because, however weird it's getting, the degree of freedom, and I mean, given everything we've seen in the last 2 to 3 years, given everything we've seen under the Putin regime, it just does not compare to what was happening under Brezhnev. We can still usually post stuff to social media. We have media. We have a certain pluralism. We have freedom of maneuver. We can be entrepreneurs, however risky and scary that is. None of that was, you know, the Soviet Union was just a completely different ballpark. Mm-hmm. So we also have to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, it's your fault we're doing this topic, thanks to the excellent piece you wrote for Business New Europe on the subject this week. What's your take, the stagnation and assertiveness of Russia today and the stagnation and assertiveness of Brezhnev era, late Brezhnev era Russia?
Well, let me start by picking up on a point that Anna made, and I'd agree. I mean, in Brezhnevism, in the Brezhnev era, you could plan because you knew things weren't going to get any better. Effectively, you had no hope. In the current era, from the point of view of ordinary Russians, they can have hope because things have got better and there are still far more opportunities. The flip side of that, and the reason why that is in some ways problematic for the regime, is that with hope comes the chance for disappointment. It's sort of the thing about the Brezhnevism was that it had actually managed to grind out much of the hope from Soviet people, and however ghastly from a human point of view that is, from a regime point of view, that's actually quite a useful thing to have. But so now I think this is the particular challenge that the regime faces. Absolutely. I mean, it has in so many ways ground to a halt. There are, I would say, no creative capacities left within this current regime. I remember that, you know, there were times when we sort of looked at what was going on and thinking, well, you know, could Putin reinvent himself in some other capacity, or is Medvedev going to bring something new? And I think it's not that we were completely sort of foolish to wonder that. I think there were the potentials. Yeah. But in each case, ultimately, a failure, an inability or unwillingness to take risks, a failure to challenge entrenched interests and so forth, ground that down. Well, I think we're now at that point. It's gone. The sort of the metaphorical Stolypin has been shot. That was the last sort of hope, I would say, for the Tsarist regime. And we're now just simply waiting to see how long the regime is going to take before it collapses. And I think that's where we are now. And a lot of the particular problems facing Russia today are familiar ones. As the economy contracts, as the political system becomes more and more competitive in the wrong sense of the word, not politically, but in terms of factions wanting to secure interests, you'll have more in the way of regional elites conspiring against the center, central elites fighting battles over struggles, but trying to keep it all out of public view and such like. But I'd also want to make one other sort of key distinction, though, between Brezhnevism and late Putinism, is that under the Brezhnev system, there was at least one political institution, which is the Soviet Communist Party. However corrupt and self-interested and far from communist it may have been, it was there. And in a way, they did provide an institution that knitted the country together, knitted the elites together, and provided both constraints but also support for the governing system, the General Secretary and the Politburo. Putin has completely deinstitutionalized power. Putin is not president and therefore rules through a series of institutions and such like. Putin is Putin, and he rules through whatever institutions he feels like today, and it may well be different tomorrow. And that gives him a lot of flexibility when he chooses to use it. For Putin, power is like a rhythmic gymnast, clearly. It's as flexible as possible and entirely at his disposal. But at the same time, it means that he also has absolutely no sort of support mechanisms, but also it means that the elite have no institutions that they can use to actually ensure that their interests are looked after and views are sort of fed into the centre. It's basically one in which it's Putinism or nothing. And so the Soviet system could actually, in its own way, painfully create an Andropov, I won't go into my usual eulogies, then Tsarchenko, and then a Gorbachev, but actually through the workings of the system, process.
Exactly.
Now, the only way that you can actually have anything different is through some kind of challenge or break. There is no political system.
So there'll be no evolution within the current arrangements, is what you're saying. Would that be a correct way to put it?
What might look from a sort of grand historical narrative as evolution will actually have to be a distinctive break. Mm-hmm. Because anyway, the next Putin that comes in, whoever that may be, is either going to be chosen and just simply be an anointed successor, or is likely to be sort of forced from within the system. But the point is, either way, it's not going to come through institutions because there are no meaningful institutions for selecting a president.
Anna, would you agree with that, first of all? And also, this is a great segue into something I wanted to talk about, comparing the Brezhnev personality cult with the Putin personality cult. This is something you know a bit about. You wrote about this about the Putin personality cult in your book, The Putin Mystique. So what would you have to say about that?
I mean, to some extent, absolutely. I mean, the role of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union is kind of it was essentially an institution that kind of replaced civil society. It was just, you know, kind of the all of you know, functioning institutional legal rational state. And but the interesting thing is that paradoxically, this actually plays along with the Putin cult in one respect, is that Putin tried to do this to an extent with United Russia. He tried to, or at least the technologists in the Kremlin, not just Putin. I mean, there was a sense that they wanted to kind of recreate United Russia as this kind of grassroots place where people could go to with their problems and, you know, just kind of solve stuff on the ground. There have been attempts to kind of get United Russia to start playing that all-encompassing role. They haven't really been successful for a number of reasons. I don't know if we want to get into them here. But what's interesting, one of the differences is that when I was looking at specifically the Putin cult, is that to what extent all of this was just a channel to get through to Putin specifically. So it's all still very personal. This is just if it is an institution, it's an institution to basically broker between individuals and the Tsar Emperor or whatever. Mm-hmm. That actually, whatever they were trying to achieve with that, what they actually ended up doing was bolstering this cult. And as to the second question about specifically the cult per se, I do want to say that, as I wrote in my book, Russia does have a propensity for these kind of power cults. I think the need for that comes from there's a structural pattern, there's structural economic that kind of reinforces those things. But there is a major differences if we're going to talk about the Putin cult, in that it is completely decentralized. Many of the trappings of what we would call the Putin cult today are coming from, like, they're not orchestrated from above. I mean, there's some, the Kremlin obviously kind of tolerates, not just tolerates this, but obviously encourages it. But the initiative is very often coming from somewhere in between or even from below. A lot of the trappings are actually people trying to capitalize on the Putin brand for their own personal gain. And the Kremlin has actually reacted in different ways to that. We've even seen to some extent where, you know, the Kremlin was none too happy about using the name Putin to, you know, as a bar or something in some region, or using, you know, Putin as a theme party at a nightclub, you know, stuff like that. That is not, this does not look like Brezhnevism, or go back to the kind of, you know, more structured, traditional, paternalistic cults that we saw in the past. And another aspect of that is, you know, the sexualization of the cult, which means that it is in very many ways a media phenomenon that kind of comes up spontaneously from various strata.
Yeah, needless to say, we didn't see the sexualization of the Brezhnev cult. Although I will say, and people have written about this, that in early Brezhnev, he was seen of this as this kind of energetic, kind of sporty kind of guy. He didn't walk around with his shirt off by any stretch of the imagination. But the Brezhnev of the jokes and the stereotypes wasn't really the Brezhnev that came into power at 64. And people have said that this is the same phenomenon as Putin ages is going to repeat itself. Mark, any thoughts on the personality cults, the respective personality cults?
Yes, I still haven't quite got beyond the idea of the Brezhnev nightclub. though, of course, he was indeed a sort of notorious hard partier.
Yes.
I think in some ways these are different processes. I mean, for Brezhnev, it's not really that the personality cult actually had any particularly great institutional value. It was more. It was just one. It was like the various medals. It was just part of. It was a perk of the job, because you were in a system which already had a whole series. You know, you'd had Marx, Engels, Lenin, and then you'd had Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, and then you were back to Marx, Engels, Lenin. There was a sort of a bit of a sort of Khrushchevian cult, and then, you know, so it was within a system, and said it was just a sort of a perk, but no one really cared about it. I mean, no one really was thinking, I must name my child after Brezhnev or whatever. With Putin, it's actually very different. It is much more about a sort of a. In this respect, it's actually more like the Stalin cult. It is much more about the very, very specific individual caricatured to superheroic status. And why is that? Well, again, because we're back to this business of there are no other institutions.
Right.
What else? I mean, Brezhnev, whatever his cult, it could never be as important as the Communist Party cult. It was, I mean, he was, shall we say, at best, a saint within the religion. But there's nothing else at the moment at the heart of this modern Russia. I mean, yes, there is a certain sort of attempt at creating historical pedigree. There is a certain sort of, you know, grandiosity about Russia's place in the world. All abstract and distant. The cult is basically representing or replacing any kind of really meaningful center about what Russia is. What does Russia really stand for? This is one of the questions which sort of, you know, one has to ask. And so often, when you do ask it to people who are meant to have an answer, the result is a stream of negatives. It is against this. It is hostile to that. It is preventing, you know, US unipolar control of the world or whatever else you want to say. But when you actually say, okay, but what is it for? That's much harder. And in a way, I think the Putin cult is an attempt to find something very kind of frothy to fill that gaping void, the heart of Putinism.
So it's empty calories in a lot of ways. I mean, another way I see, another similarity I see and difference is that the Brezhnev system, and specifically the late Brezhnev system, was based less on out and out, all out repression than on passive acquiescence. And on passive acquiescence, essentially. And you could say the same thing about most of the Putin period until about 2 years ago, when it was suddenly all about mobilization. And now you have to wonder, because they had lost the passive acquiescence in 2011, 2012. You have to wonder now, can they go back to passive acquiescence? Or does this have to be a permanent mobilization society? Go ahead, Mark.
I mean, have they really lost it? I mean, yes, there was Bolotnaya and so forth.
No, they lost it briefly, and they thought they had to do something, and they went to mobilization, is the way I see it.
But, I mean, I look out at Moscow, and I don't see a country or a city being mobilized. I see a city in which actually people live in their lives, and okay, in Moscow, people live better lives than out in the provinces. But it's not that I think that we have some new Sparta being born out in Belgorod.
No, it looked that way a couple of years ago, but they've eased off of that lately.
But I think, again, two points I'd make. One is we were focusing on, shall we say, the propaganda. Rather than the realities. It's the same way as at different times, if you look, and again, here we go to the Brezhnev era. If you look at the propaganda, you think of the Soviet Union as being precisely this, I mean, and the term was used then, New Sparta, this thoroughly militarized, mobilized country. And then in practice, it was this ramshackle. It was much more Gogol than anything else. It was one in which everyone kind of pretended, and you pad the plan, and you lie in your teeth about all the activities that you're doing. And in practice, people are just simply living their own lives, scheming, stealing, doing whatever just to get by.
And you see that today as well. You see the parallel there.
Very much. I think sort of there is a little propaganda bubble. You know, if you watch the television, obviously, there is this extraordinary, virulent, vitriolic propaganda being spewed out biliously.
Although it's eased up in the last 6 months or so.
Well, to an extent, but still, it definitely still has very much its moments. but nonetheless, you know, when you actually go out there, yes, I think there is a general sense about some things, oh, the West isn't being very nice to us or whatever. But the idea that this actually has reshaped public consciousness is one that I find very hard to believe. You know, I think we are back to this fact of the factors that Russians, just like anyone else, are perfectly capable of living in an environment of a certain sort of rhetorical devices and, where necessary, saying the right things, but in practice just simply living normal lives as normal human beings.
So back to psychological dualism, the famous what we had in the past. Anna, your thoughts on this?
I just wanted to add to that, I mean, if we're going to talk about acquiescence, I mean, are people passively, like the degree of passivity in their support for Putin? And I noticed in the heyday of the whole Ukraine mobilization, when we really saw Putin's approval ratings jump to like around 90%, what I noticed was something quite interesting in terms of the passion with which you want to, you know, support Putin as opposed to defy him. And I mean, for instance, even around then, take an opposition rally, a liberal opposition rally in Moscow in the heyday of this, you know, pro-Kremlin patriotic mobilization campaign, you'd still see an opposition rally garner somewhere in the tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we saw the Nemtsov rally last month was 24,000.
Okay, but that's an exception. Nemtsov is that's not your run of the mill opposition rally. That's marking the assassination of one of the biggest opposition figure in the country.
There was a March for Peace that I think this was late 2014. That I would say was somewhere around those numbers, mm-hmm. perhaps even bigger. And at the same time, and I wrote about this back then, we were also seeing patriotic rallies for the Ukrainian cause, Help Donbass, let's get aid to our volunteers fighting in Ukraine alongside the separatists, a few hundred people. And I attended these rallies. I saw what a lot of people there were talking about, some of the organizers, and there was a sense of, we are not getting enough support from the Kremlin guys. And this is very interesting. Like, when there are grassroots efforts to kind of rally around that cause, they're still more passive than the efforts mm-hmm. to pr- protest. And that's interesting. I would say this speaks to the nature of passive acquiescence. I mean, it is by definition passive. It's not passionate except for a couple of, you know, spurts here and there, but more or less it is by definition a passive thing.
Mark, you want to say something?
Yeah, I definitely would want to agree and say in so many ways this is what the Kremlin wants. I think this is a Kremlin that mistrusts passion, mistrusts activity, and would much rather everyone would just simply happily just stay at home having a drink and watching TV. I'm minded also at the time of you know when the whole Donbass issue was kicking off, you would see these little sort of tents, particularly outside metro stations, of you know support the Donbass, so people could sign up for more information, give money, give donations, presumably come along and find out how they could volunteer, quote unquote, to go and fight or whatever. So there were all these blue and white striped little tents around, with someone there. I not once saw anyone stop. Everyone just walked past with all the same attentiveness that in the New York subway you give to the Jehovah's Witnesses or whoever. the point is, there was a substantial flow of quote-unquote donations from the organization that ran these that went to the Donbass. This was not for a moment because they expected ordinary Russians to put their hand in their pockets and provide money. It's that the state wanted to be able to do this, and therefore it really needed just to have a little bit of a sort of fake public outreach so that effectively it could launder state money. It was actually always government money that was going to the Donbass while they said, oh, this has just been collected through sort of charitable donations. And so often I think that is actually a metaphor for the mobilization regime. It's actually often a fake mobilization regime. With all, you know, I mean, not even the sort of Subotnik style mobilization, you know, you are required to volunteer to do this. It's actually that just purely it's a fiction while the state gets on with doing state things. Mm-hmm. Again, this is one of the interesting similarities and differences with the Brezhnev era. Part of the social contract, you know, the so-called little deal of Brezhnevism, was precisely your life will get better. But in return, you just sit back and let the Communist Party run the country. That was also the essence of Putin's social contract. And in the first two terms, Putin delivered. Everyone's lives did get much, much
better. And in early Brezhnevism, Brezhnev delivered.
Precisely. But then what happened is, in both countries, for different reasons, though to a large extent because of oil prices and hydrocarbons, right. the money gets short. In both cases, what happens, the regime decides who is going to pay for this? Who is going to suffer? Is it going to be the elite and the military and the military-industrial complex, or is it going to be
consumers,
the ordinary sod in the streets? And both times, we know which choice they made. The little deal is broken. People realize that. But at the same time, they realize that the state is a powerful thing to challenge and gets nasty and vengeful if you do try and challenge it. So instead, they opt out. Mm-hmm. We're nowhere near the levels of disillusion and disenchantment of late Brezhnevism. But in a way, well, we've only had a couple of years, really, of this contraction and this, this betrayal of the little deal. And to be honest, this regime is also much, much less solidly rooted than the Soviet one. But nonetheless, I mean, I do think there are really quite striking trajectories. And in each case, the point is that a state that has basically built its relationship with the public on just stay out of our way can't then easily turn round and say, you know, when we said that, actually what we mean is get involved, participate, and not be regarded with a certain degree of scorn.
Well, let's pick up on that to segue into, like, what about those who don't opt out and those that don't go along with the regime, but those who oppose it? How would you compare the dissident movement in the 70s with the opposition today? I guess this is something certainly something I wanted to touch on before we moved on. Mark, go ahead, or Anna. I know you've done a lot of work on the opposition.
I'm much less of a sort of, you know, 70s dissident scholar or whatever. I think there's this whole variety of different contexts. I mean, the dissident movement was having to operate in an environment in which basically there were no legitimate outlets for expressing views. So in a way, so much of what the dissidents had to concentrate on was, you know, how to get the word out. You know, was it going to be Samizdat? Was it going to be underground meetings? Was it indeed be to sort of get out and start broadcasting for Radio Liberty or for the BBC Russian language service or whatever? Now things are rather different because, as Anna has rightly said, you know, there are media outlets, there are the opportunities to organise and so forth, up to a point, but it's a very different environment. So anyway, the challenge for today's dissident is not so much being able to talk to the people who are already like-minded, which was really a problem for the dissidents. It's how to talk to other people in an age when actually you're competing in such a dense and complex information environment.
So today's dissidents have an advantage on the dissidents of then or not?
Well, I mean...
Can I jump
in? Yeah, definitely.
In?
Please do.
Okay. Well, I mean, Mark made some really good points here. And the thing is, I think one of the major challenges for the opposition is to the extent to which they can adapt to new opportunities of reaching out to their compatriots. I mean, what I've seen in the past, and even in the during the Bolotnaya movement, is it almost felt like a lot of the opposition movements we've been seeing is that they're still kind of stuck in the Soviet resistance paradigm, where you're essentially trying to get your views across to people who are like-minded and resisting the state. This is understandable, and to an extent, it's still important. But there are, I think, other priorities right now if we want to build a successful, civil society, successful opposition movement with leverage over the government. That's outreach, and I haven't really seen a lot of that happening. I mean, we saw some successes in Navalny's campaign, his anti-corruption campaign, his political campaign. We saw some successful outreach efforts. A lot of them, in fact. I mean, it's just we're going to have to see where this goes in the near future to see, like, if it's going to be successful on a more, civil society level.
Okay. And one other thing the final thing I wanted to hit on, and I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this, actually, is the foreign policy similarities of the two periods, because the late 70s saw, amid all this stagnation, a very, very, very assertive Soviet Union. You saw them moving into Africa, in Asia, making inroads in Latin America, which ultimately climaxed with a grand failure in Afghanistan. And likewise today, you see an extremely assertive Russia with the Ukraine and the Syria conflicts. And there's a lot of speculation of where it's going to go next. One way to look at today's assertiveness is that it is an attempt to legitimize the regime, given the domestic failures. I'm not sure I see that as that being the case in the Brezhnev period. I think there was a different dynamic going on then. Mark, what do you think?
Yes, I mean, one only needs look at the comparison between Soviet war in Afghanistan, which after all was a secret war until Gorbachev's time. And the very reason for openness about Afghanistan was actually to create a necessary political groundswell to begin to bring the boys home, compared with the full-on technicolor war porn that we have on Russian TV from Syria. Clearly, these are two very different dynamics. The other sort of difference is that in the 1970s, the Soviet Union was an undoubted superpower. Now, particularly with hindsight, we now know that it was in some ways a hollow superpower, that a lot of its actual strength was more illusory than real. But the point is, as far as both the Soviets and the outside world was concerned, it was clearly one of the two poles. And therefore, it was engaged in this Manichaean competition for basically control of the world, this global risk. Whereas today, I mean, actually, the thing is that no one rightly regards Russia as a great superpower outside maybe of
the Garden Ring
Canal, and the Kremlin and a certain bit of a Odintsova. So that actually this is much more aggressive and risk-taking precisely because it's built about trying to create a sense of capacity and identity, a sense of a role for itself in the world. Russia is being a lot more scrappy, whereas actually in the 1970s, really, it was more of a sort of a push-pull thing. I mean, one could just as easily say in the 1970s, the West or the United States was also being very aggressive and assertive. That was the essential dynamic of the world as it was then. Now we actually have an irony of a West that is much more about, hey, have your sovereignty and build up your economic capacity, and by the way, do buy your financial services from us. Whereas it's the Russians who are kind of pushing in this one-sided conflict. So, I mean, I think that although on the surface it might look similar, in practice I think it's very different in its wellsprings, because actually the Soviet Union in the 1970s, the state did not realize, or most of the state did not realize how bad things were.
Mm. One similarity I would point to is that in how the 70s, in the global sense, is similar to today, is that then the West was going through one of its periods. And Mark, I would disagree that in the late 70s, the West was actually kind of retrenching. It was going through one of its periodic periods of reassessment. In this case, it's particularly the U.S. after the Vietnam War, this period of self-doubt, this period of retrenchment, similar to what we're seeing today in the wake of the Iraq War, with a U.S. that is actually much less assertive than it had been before. And Russia, I think, senses, the Soviet Union and Russia, senses these opportunities and moves. This is a moment that they seem to know they have the opportunity to exploit.
I question that, because I don't think that Russia is being pushed by perceived opportunity. I don't think it's a case that actually just simply Russia was thinking, well, we hadn't planned to do this, but because America is being weak. Because, you see, I don't think Russia has the same perspective as you. It might well be that you're absolutely right about America sort of retrenching or whatever.
Just periodically, this is a natural, organic process. We go through this.
Might disagree with that perspective. But I think as the world looks from Moscow, or at least from official Moscow circles, I think what they believe is that a West, and when they say West, they always mean the United States, that you might say, yes, has retreated from the kind of Iraq model of outright physical conquest, shall we say, but instead has moved to this Gibridnaya Voina, to this model of color revolutions and so forth. I really don't think it's just purely a rhetorical flourish. I absolutely believe that if you go to the Foreign Ministry Tower or the General Staff, let alone the Kremlin, actually what you get is a much more alarmed perspective of the West.
Well, this is one of the great unknowns right now, is do they believe their own hype? On any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this, and this is actually, it's really hard to say to what extent this we're seeing a foreign policy strategy is actually being driven by its own domestic propaganda. And I've kind of wavered on this from time to time in the last 2 years, because I'm just seeing, I mean, given the lack of a domestic strategy, of course, that's going to, you know, impact its whole foreign policy. But I mean, it almost feels as though what happened in 2013, 2014, you know, with the whole overhaul of domestic propaganda, that we're now seeing just necessity to kind of, okay, play into that. It's kind of becoming, we're kind of stuck in that, okay, I guess we have no other, you know, no other option than to keep playing this game, whether we believe our own hype or not.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of a self-perpetuating process that they it's like a treadmill they can't get off, in other words.
Yeah. And again, what are they going to do, essentially? I mean, yes, with Syria, it's a bit different. There is some modicum of potential success, and it is an actual military involvement as opposed to a not military involvement in Ukraine. But it's still, you know, there's still so many unknowns, such a, you know, what's the end game, you know, in terms of combining domestic and foreign policy, that we don't know how this is going to play out and how domestic is going to, you know, impact foreign and the other way around.
Well, that brings me to how we want to wrap up this segment. I mean, if you pull it all together, What do the 70s show us about today, and where's this going? If you were what we know about the 70s, what we know about now, we know how that ended. Mark, what do you think? Is this what does this portend?
Well, let's push back to sort of the earlier point about the, sort of the lack of institutions and therefore the scope for change from within the system. If you are someone within the Russian elite, however sort of you choose to define that, today, who is thinking, wow, things are going really badly. We need a complete change of direction, and the current guy at the top cannot provide that. And let's face it, there are a lot of people who are thinking that or are beginning to incline towards that. Okay, the question is, what can you do about it? And this is the real challenge. There is no real sort of constitutional mechanism for doing anything about it. Okay, theoretically, you could say, let's wait for the next presidential elections, but everyone knows that that's not how elections work in Russia. So I think that is, for me, the real challenge, is that in the 1970s, you still could have, God help us for saying this, but, trust in the Communist Party. At least trust in the fact that there is going to be an institution, and that, thank God, your general secretary is old and has already died a couple of times.
Well, that's another key variable, that the generational change was key to the change that happened from the 70s to the 80s. That whole new generation.
Well, hold on, because, they can't keep bringing Brezhnev back. It's like the Die Hard franchise or something. So that there was some kind of scope for hope. I don't see scope for that kind of, shall I say, hope within the system or within the institutions in the current circumstances. So instead, people are looking to get out, just keep their head down, or in due course may actually have to do something a bit more dramatic.
So is that a recipe for extended stagnation? Is that a recipe for revolution? What is that a recipe for? Is that
I don't see how the current status quo can last. Long term. I mean, stagnation could have continued. I mean, let's face it. Let's say the political calculus had been slightly different, and instead of getting the Andropov-Chernenko-Gorbachev trinity, they'd, let's say, gone for one of the sort of younger, Grishin or Romanov.
Right, Romanov, yeah.
There were people around who at least had a certain degree of vigor. And probably stagnation could have continued for another decade before, in due course, the inevitable sort of caught up with it. I certainly can't see how this current status quo can last, not least because elites and masses alike have got a sense of something different. Again, to loop round to the very first point, the Brezhnev system was very effective in destroying any hope for change.
Mm.
Whereas actually, I think people today have rather different expectations.
Uh-huh. Anna, your thoughts?
Oh, I'm going to go on a limb and maybe say something a bit radical. I think the current model of governance and governance, and maybe even models of governance that we've seen maybe in the last 100 years, I think they've outlived themselves. And this really pushes up to a different question. Maybe the issue is that the current type of country that Russia is has kind of outlived itself. And what we're really going to have to see is, not just on a level of governance, but on a level of society, on a level of community, on a level of identity, ultimately, is how are Russians going to begin to see themselves as a nation? Again, it's this question of, from empire to nation, how is that transition ever going to take place? And is now the time for that transition to take place? I think that's a very important and a very volatile question. We don't have answers for that. But I think ultimately that's what we're kind of pushing up against, because I just don't really see, in terms of politics, in terms of policy, I don't really see this as a policy issue anymore. I don't even see this as a type of governance issue anymore. I see this as something far more fundamental that we're going to see down the road.
No, and you actually had a very interesting article on that very theme that came across my feed yesterday that I recommend everybody take a look at. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at a force that could challenge the Putin regime in the near future, and it's not one you would expect. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFE. IRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Moscow is journalist and author Anna Araturian, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Personality Cult. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Готовятся к выборам. Российские коммунисты
спросим. Российские коммунисты начали активно готовиться.
Ведь коммунисты специально заявили, что не сегодняшняя
встреча. Коммунистам не понравилось, что Путин.
Российские коммунисты ведь начали.
Коммунисты готовят собственные.
When Russians go to the polls in 6 month time to elect a new Duma, there might be an unexpected opposition force challenging the Kremlin. They have a powerful network to rally supporters and get out the vote. They plan to focus on official incompetence and corruption, and the Kremlin would be foolish to ignore the threat they pose. Or that, at least, is what Mark would have us believe, judging from his latest piece in Vox. Mark, you've been very prolific, giving me topics to have for the podcast. Enlighten us. Who is this mysterious opposition force that's going to challenge the Kremlin?
Well, alas, your audio mashup was full of spoilers. It is, of course, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation.
Zhuganov's communists are going to challenge Putin's regime.
Absolutely, but not in a direct way. Look, I mean, I don't for a moment think, firstly, that Zhuganov, who clearly has become thoroughly accustomed to his current role as the fake opposition leader of the fake opposition, has any particular enthusiasm for the fight. And likewise, it's not for a minute that I think the communists actually pose any kind of electoral threat to United Russia. Rather, what it is that I do think that we're seeing a very different kind of combination of Communist Party and the environment in which they're operating. Having for so long been so accustomed to basically sort of making false campaigns just for the sake of it, it looks like they're gearing up to be a little bit more carnivorous this time. We had a few signs. The campaigners' talking points for this time. In the past, they have been again. This is I haven't seen any from the 1990s, but in sort of the 03, 07, 11, they tend to be incredibly banal documents. They tend to be, you know, what do we stand for? We stand for looking after war veterans and pensioners. You know, who has an opinion? You know, who actually comes up and says, you know, what does your party stand for? Oh, well, screwing over war
veterans. Right.
This is all strictly godmom and apple pie stuff. This time round, though, it's much more about emphasizing mismanagement and corruption within the government. So in other words, instead of just simply sort of making easy banalities, it actually is specifically targeting the government. And more to the point, targeting issues that are already neuralgic points because of the times in which we're in. We now have an environment, unlike the earlier elections, where people are dissatisfied, uncertain about the future. And they're very well aware of corruption. They're very well aware of mismanagement. To actually have a political party raising these issues, I think, is uncomfortable. And it's also extended to the way that Duma deputies, Communist Duma deputies, or at least some of them, have been acting of late. We saw two interesting new bills in recent months, neither of which is going to get anywhere. But that's not the point. One bill which was basically saying that anyone who'd been convicted of corruption should be barred for life from having state employment, which, again, given the usual carousel whereby everyone is a bad, bad person and then a couple of years later is reinstated.
Or a couple of months later.
Well, yes, right. I'm being overgenerous. And the other one was actually saying that families of officials should be barred from engagement in business that relates to the official's role. Again, which we know full well.
Would shut down the economy.
Well, it certainly would shut down the Duma economy. So it's not that this is going to become law. And in that respect, it's a metaphor for how I think the communists are going to work. It's not that actually they're going to change anything in gross, visible terms. It's actually though they're raising a bunch of issues, they're pushing a bunch of issues, which I think is going to be uncomfortable for the regime to be addressing. This might, in that respect, round the edges of what is inevitably going to be a very managed process, be much more of a real election campaign, at least on the streets, than we've seen in the past.
So are they breaking out of their assigned role? Are they going rogue? Or is this sanctioned? And it's a way of siphoning off discontent with the regime in the very safe vessel of the Communist Party of Gennady Zhuganov.
Well, this is interesting because actually Anna and I were having a conversation off mic, and so she may well be expressing a different perspective. I think that it's actually not sanctioned. I mean, still, Zhuganov is not going rogue. He's definitely that all now, for which I think we can all be very grateful. But I think it's been pushed from the grassroots, because it's an interesting thing. I mean, I'm trying to speak to some people who have some awareness of what's going on within the Communist Party, especially out in the regions. And what seems to be emerging is that you really do have a strongly bifurcated party of the classic Stalinist grannies, who have always been the sort of the bedrock, and who tend to have often thoroughly disagreeable, ultra-nationalist, borderline, if not over the borderline, racist, etc. perspectives. But then actually a newer generation of 20 to 30-something-year-olds who are not, they don't want to bring back a Soviet communist model or anything like that. It's just that if you are opposed to the current order and vaguely of leftist, collectivist leanings, the only place where you can actually find a party, rather than just simply getting a bunch of friends together, if you want to join something and have a machine and so forth and have some chance, especially in local politics, of being able to have some traction, then the Communist Party is the only place. So you've got
since they took Udaltsov out of the system, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it seems to be basically pressure from the grassroots that is forcing Zhuganov to sanction rather than lead this process. I mean, it doesn't help that Putin also has been dissing Lenin.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second.
But yeah, I mean, and sort of, I think that the final point is that, yes, this is something that we've seen in the past, but firstly, I think actually we're seeing a Kremlin that these days is much, much less effective in its management of the political system. But secondly, we're now seeing a very different environment from previous elections where everything was fine.
Anna, let's take your argument with Mark from off mic to on mic and have at it.
Okay, you guys ready?
Go,
Okay.
Well, I'm braced.
really a slight disagreement. Maybe not. The thing is, I mean, I've seen this story before. And even what Mark has said just now, this is a story that I'm not I'm getting a sense of deja vu. The communists have been, for instance, about tax policy, the communists have been hammering Putin about a flat tax rate since he was prime minister, and he's had to continually deflect that. And from the exchanges I've seen, in the State Duma when Putin was prime minister of the KPRF, it was really a conversation that ultimately makes everyone look good. Even back then, and this was, I think, around 2010, 2011. And the same with, for instance, more funding for agriculture. I've seen pretty heated debates over that for years. And yes, in the context of, for instance, import substitution right now, and the low oil prices, this is a conversation that has become a lot more critical than in previous election cycles. But it is largely the same conversation. And if there is a dark horse, it may well be corruption, as Mark said. But again, who started this conversation? And I feel like it was the Kremlin itself, either because it was threatened by a free radical anti-corruption crusader like Alexei Navalny, or it began to recognize corruption for the security threat that it is. Either way, something as strategically complex and potentially volatile as, for instance, the deofshoreization campaign, the government's attempts to get elite capital back within its borders, I don't see this so much as a communist talking point as a Kremlin security matter that the communists are happy to jump on. Now, what is interesting is the pressure from grassroots, because I saw the same kind of pressure as early as 2007, the same kind of divide between the old style grannies, your grandfather's variety of communism and kind of the new generation. That was the point when we started seeing relatively young, savvy, independent-minded people gravitating towards KPRF, not from the standpoint of ideology, but from a more pragmatic perspective of, say, an opposition that could actually stand up for them as, dare I say, entrepreneurs. And this was a very interesting time in that regard. We saw, for instance, a lot of independent labor activity, guys that struck me as having learned how to count the money in their pockets rather than pine for the days of the Soviet Union. Then there was the economic crisis of 2008. This magnetized KPRF to a different extent, the Just Russia Party, which was far more independent back then than it was today. And then there was a culmination of all of this with the Bolotnaya protest movement. And since then, I've seen a lot of disillusionment.
Yes, there is a strong economic-minded base that is looking to KPRF as essentially the only force looking out for them. We saw this with the truckers' strike this winter when KPRF picked up on their demands. But aside from rhetorical pressure, I'm not sure I'm seeing real structural leverage or lobbying from the grassroots level. That might change, and the big question is that we don't know how. And I think neither does the Kremlin. I'm with Mark on that, because there are no traditions for that kind of structural political leverage. And when and if that starts happening, and the economic crisis is a major factor here, yes, the Kremlin is going to be unprepared, because we just don't know how that's going to play out.
One of the things that and Mark, you noted this in your piece, and I did a piece on this a few weeks back, Why Putin's Afraid of Lenin, is the year 2017 is coming up. 100th anniversary of the revolution, and the Kremlin doesn't appear to know how to handle this. Thus, if we've been recalling you alluded to this, Mark, Putin's comments dishing Lenin for putting a time bomb under the state. There's this real ambivalence about this, because they don't want to celebrate 1917. They don't want that Soviet Union. They don't want the revolutionary Soviet Union of that period. They want the Soviet Union that was the military discipline of the Stalin Soviet Union, which was an established state, not a revolutionary state. How does this all play in, the ambivalence about 1917, about Lenin, about revolution? How does this play in with this resurgence or non-resurgence of the Communist Party we're seeing right now?
I mean, I personally don't think it's a sort of a major issue. I mean, I think the fact of Putin's comments about Lenin, it stirs up, as it were, the existing party base. But again, that's no big deal. I think it'll be more an interesting issue next year when it comes. I think 2017 is a long way away in most people's minds, especially when you have elections between then. While we're all being self-referential, I mean, let me actually go back to your piece. I quite like the fact that you actually sort of talked about the Bolshevik Revolution as being, as it were, the first color revolution. The red one. Because in some ways, I think that is exactly the problem for the Putin regime, is that actually they don't like anything that involves instability and major change and turnover. But I mean, I can just go back to some of Anna's points, which I think sort of links into this and this whole issue of, as it were, change versus stability. You know, things like deoffshoreization, which was, as it were, the complement or the Kremlin's approach to anti-corruption, is very, very different. Deoffshoreization just simply means you can keep your dirty money, but just please keep it in our banks rather than Swiss or British or American banks. Whereas, you know, from the communist point of view, it's actually we want to go after these people who have been stealing our money. So, I mean, I think one of the problems is that Putin cannot, without picking fights with the elite that he's clearly not willing to do, actually address on a fundamental level the corruption issue. In a way that outsiders can, whether it's Navalny or the communists, because they haven't really got any stake. And to this extent, I mean, if one looks at just simply the math, I mean, talked about the 07 elections, in which sort of, Anna was saying you began to see that. That actually was the elections in which, certainly according to the official figures, the communists got the smallest share of the vote since 1991, 11.6%. Then it went up to 19.2% in 2011. And at the moment, we don't know. I mean, the Levada polls, and I generally think Levada is the best of the polling agencies, back in November, which is in the last sort of data I saw, they were saying that the communists were at 11%. But if you actually look at a proportion of those people who are definitely planning on voting, they're already at 17%. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not going to suddenly leap up to 51%. The point is not, as it were, that the communists are going to apply direct leverage to the system. They are not going to change anything in the system. They're not going to be able to change anything in the system. And frankly, Zyuganov would not be on their side in trying to do that. The point is just simply that when you actually begin to have, in an environment like today's, some open and real discussion about some real problems that everyone knows about, and as it were, within the context of a sort of an electoral mobilization cycle, because the Kremlin needs to get people out to vote. I mean, because elections are essentially measures of legitimacy, right, as far as it's
The legitimation rituals,
Exactly. Although it would love to simply say, look, oh, don't bother about it. Oh, the elections, oh, sorry, we held those last week. Sorry, we didn't mention it. No, it actually has to get at least enough people out to vote that when they rig the elections, it won't look too ridiculous. And that's the problem, because the most effective way that many people can, after all, express their disapproval with the system is just not turning out. Or if they're going to turn out, voting for someone else. If the communists can just simply get people talking about articulating their disagreement and believing that it is possible for there to be some alternative to the current regime, again, we're back to the issue of hope and imagination, then actually that, I think, is deeply corrosive. And it doesn't bring down the government, but it forces the government to kind of distort itself, contort itself to do more in order to simply maintain its own power. We saw that with Blotnaya. Who knows what we're going to see this time around?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. As we come up to the end, and since we're talking about the communists, I couldn't help but notice Putin's comments yesterday, where he warned Russians against being, and I'm quoting directly, dizzy with success. We went back to the 70s in the first part. This is kind of back to the 30s. What was Putin doing that? Why did he use that phrase? He used that exact phrase, and from Stalin's famous article in 1930 in Pravda. What do you think was? Did you pick up on this? And
I have absolutely no idea. It's like Angela Merkel cribbing lines out of Mein Kampf.
Right. No, I mean it was mind blowing. I mean, I had to. I was like, holy! Did he really actually say that? But yes, he did. Anna, did you pick up on this? And do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, Putin does that a lot. It goes back to this whole theatricality. I'm going to pretend. It's like this whole postmodern Stalin concept. I'm going to do this, you know. It's going to look like it, but it's not going to be the real thing, in hopes that, you know, oh, hint, hint, you know, we all get what, yeah, we all get who this guy really is. But then again, he's not. And I'm not sure whether that's a strategy, whether that's deliberate. I mean, there's certainly a wink-wink situation going on. I mean, every time he does this, there is a wink-wink situation going on. But I don't see the strategy here.
To write a blog about it, and I was like, why the hell did he say that? I couldn't figure out what the point was, and so therefore I avoided writing about it.
Well, what's particularly interesting is, if one thinks of the context of Stalin's dizzy with success, it's when, you know, he'd launched collectivization. Yep. This whirlwind of misery and massacre had swept through the country. And clearly he realized the need to step back and regroup. And he also wanted to disassociate himself with the more extreme measures which had been used. And hence dizzy with success, to allow him to try and look like the good guy, and then obviously to return to the struggle shortly thereafter. So, I was even trying to think, well, you know, let's assume, because if nothing else, anyone who's been through the Soviet education system should know the Communist Party history to an extent.
Everybody knows that phrase.
To have used such a specific phrase, I mean, is he trying to imply that what's been going on in the country isn't really down to him, but, you know, the mini Putins, and he wants to rein them back? I see no other signs thereof, but that will almost be the implication.
Yeah, no, I didn't write about it because I just couldn't unpack it. But anyway, I thought it would be something to throw out there as we wrapped up. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Moscow has been journalist and author Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.